This is The Guardian.
Today, world leaders are preparing to meet at the COP26 climate conference in Glasgow next week. It's seen as one of the last chances to keep global heating below 1.5 degrees. But what will the world look like at an extra 2 degrees, 3 degrees, or even 4 degrees? Until now, human civilization has existed within a narrow, stable band of temperatures. But through the years of burning fossil fuels, we have very gradually warmed the planet. But suddenly, things aren't so gradual. Since 1970, the Earth's temperature has raced upwards faster than in any comparable period. The oceans have heated at a rate not seen in 11,000 years.
There's so many different ways to measure it. As a species, humans have become brilliant at monitoring their problems, but not so good at solving them.
Scientists use thermometers on ships and buoys, land stations and satellites.
All of this data is collected together, and that gives us a picture of these really significant planet-wide trends of the temperature of the land, and of the oceans, and of the air. And all of them are warming. Everything is warming.
How high that warming goes is now a matter of politics. Back in 2015, leaders agreed to limit temperature rises to 1.5 degrees. Next week in Glasgow, leaders will reaffirm that commitment and offer up their solutions to meet that target.
Countries representing more than half of the global GDP are committed to taking steps that will keep us within reach of our joint pursuit of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius.
We must limit the rise in temperatures, whose appalling effects were visible even this summer, to 1.5 degrees.
The alternatives hardly bear thinking about.
I'm here to sound the alarm. The world must wake up. We are on the edge of an abyss and moving in the wrong direction.
From The Guardian, I'm Nosheen Iqbal. Today in Focus, a question of degrees. What a warmer world will mean for all of us. We'll go into the science and the global picture in a minute. But before we do, let's get right down to the ground.
When you go out into a sugar field in the morning, it can be really deceptively peaceful, actually. You'll hear the sharpening machetes as the guys prepare for their day. Often these are in coastal lowlands with volcanoes or mountains in the background. And that dawn light's coming in and it's filtering through the sugar cane, and that sugar cane is going on for miles in every direction.
Jason Glazer runs La Isla Network, an NGO advocating for outdoor workers in Central America. Over a decade ago, they started with sugarcane cutters in Nicaragua.
These are almost exclusively young men, incredibly good shape, just lean and mean. And they're out there preparing, but as the day goes on, it stops being this kind of like bucolic, peaceful scene of people preparing for work, and it just becomes grueling.
Luis is a supervisor on the fields now, describing shifts that could go all day without a single break.
It's just unbelievably hot, anywhere from 32 to 40 degrees Celsius. There are men working often with no protection, no hat, no shirt. There's dust everywhere coming up from the ground. There's heat coming from the ground itself because before they go out to cut, they burn the sugarcane. So everything has this kind of sickly sweet smell, and that's rising up. And so you get heat from the ground, and you've got this unbelievably brutal tropical sun beating down. And so people would just be slugging it out, cutting 6 to 9 tons a day, 10 to 12 hours a day, 6 to 7 days a week.
And La Isla noticed something again and again. Many of these workers, after season of working in this heat, were dying in their 20s and 30s.
The impact of the work in the fields is blunt and it's pernicious. It's blunt in the sense that people can have an outright heat stroke and end up in the hospital or dead. The more pernicious part is damage over time that we believe leads to chronic disease. So that kidney is really distressed because of the workload and the heat strain that these guys go under, and also dehydration plays a role. And as more research comes out, it looks like the kidney becomes kind of the locus and the focus of that duress, of that stress from that work. And then you can end up with a chronic disease, kidney disease, which really in this context is a terminal disease.
Walter, a former sugar cutter, is now on dialysis. He was diagnosed when his two daughters were less than 10 years old. William, who worked in the field since he was 12, now works for La Isla. He lost his dad, his uncle, and his grandfather to kidney disease.
He sido muy afectado porque mi papá falleció por la enfermedad renal, por ejemplo, mis tíos, mis abuelos. Entonces eso me ha conllevado.
And they are not alone. Tens of thousands of workers in Central America, and more in South Asia too, have died from this kidney disease. And though the exact cause is not clear, many scientists blame the same thing: intense work in intense heat. La Isla advocate for some pretty simple solutions: water, shade, regular breaks. And through their partners, they say their work is having an impact. But they face a problem on a much larger scale too. The region, the Earth, is getting hotter still.
I know when I've talked to some workers, yeah, they worry about global warming. They feel like they've experienced it. A lot of the old timers say the conditions seem worse than they were even when they were young. I do think when you're facing some of the challenges folks are facing on the ground with like sick family or the possibility that you yourself might get sick, things are a little bit on a shorter timeline and you're more concerned about the immediacy of relief.
John, you're The Guardian's global environment editor. We've just been hearing how heat waves in Nicaragua are affecting outdoor workers. And we throw around this term global warming or global heating, but it's probably useful at this point to remind us what we actually mean by it.
What we mean is that we are pushing up the temperature of our planet, the Earth, as a result of human emissions. That might be car exhaust or factory chimneys or burning down trees and forests. All of these emissions are turning up the dial. And so far, since the start of the industrial era, about 200 years ago, we've pushed up the dial by 1.1 degrees Celsius.
Greenhouse gases in the Earth's atmosphere hit a record high this year. This is according to a United Nations report released this week. It says global temperatures have also risen by about 1.1 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels.
Now, that might not sound very much. After all, if you go out and it's 26 degrees and then soon after that, it's 27 degrees. You probably don't even notice that 1 degree. But rather than thinking about it in those terms, I think it's more useful to consider a body's temperature. 1 degree for us is the difference between a healthy temperature and a fever. And we are now, our planetary body is now in a slight fever at 1.1 degrees. And just as with a human body, the higher the temperature, the greater the risk of very serious damage.
Can you actually drill it down in terms of the impact on the world, for people, for the environment? Specifically, what is it that we're seeing recently?
What this means is we're getting longer droughts, we're getting more severe heat waves, and we're seeing much more extreme hot days.
CBC meteorologist Joanna Wagstaff is among those sweltering under that heat dome. But Joanna, I see you have some
earlier
trees
this summer in Lytton in Canada. In Canada, you know, very far north country, there was a temperature of, I think it was 49.6 degrees Celsius, almost 50 degrees on a latitude very similar to the UK.
Hannah, the shade is helping a little bit, but I've got to tell you, I have no air conditioning, as does most, over half of British Columbians. I had to go to my sister's basement last night with the whole family to beat the heat. Our overnight lows in Vancouver.
In the past, we would associate those sorts of temperatures only on very rare occasions in very few places such as the Sahara Desert. These kinds of extremes are being seen in more and more places and more often. Just this year, we've seen really savage heat and extreme fires in places as far afield as Siberia to California. We've seen desperately awful floods in Germany and in China, and just temperatures rising and hitting records in many, many places, including this summer in the host city of COP26, Glasgow.
Dry with long spells of sunshine for many places, and those temperatures still way up for the time of year. We're looking at fairly widely 21 to 23 Celsius, perhaps 24 or 25 degrees out towards Glasgow, the West Highlands.
Is there any way we can hold the temperature at 1.1 or even reverse it?
We cannot hold the temperature to 1.1. It's too late for that.
Today's IPCC report says a global 1.5 Celsius temperature rise is now inescapable, perhaps within 20 years.
There is a lot of momentum in the climate system. It responds with a lag. So everything we are experiencing now in terms of temperature rise was essentially caused by emissions from 10, 20, 30 years ago. And so everything we're emitting now, the consequences will be felt in the coming decades. So it's definitely too late to just make a full stop. And scientists tell us that the best we can hope for is 1.5 degrees Celsius. That is the goal of goals. It's also enshrined in the Paris Climate Agreement as the most ambitious of the targets that the international community has agreed to. The band that they said the world should aim for was between 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius. Even within that band, the lower you get it, the less risk there is. It's not like we're going to suddenly fall off a cliff if we get past 1.5 or we get to 2. But with every fraction of a degree, more people will be affected.
So you sort of told us why that figure, the 1.5 figure, is so important. But what does actually start happening to the world at 1.5 degrees?
There's already big changes happening to the climate system. It's becoming more of an angry beast. The more we prod it, that is, the more we raise the temperature, the more angry that beast is going to be. So at 1.5 degrees, you'll be seeing more extreme weather, you'll be seeing longer droughts, there will be an increased risk to the world's coral systems all collapsing, there will be some degree of increased risk of the Amazon rainforest reaching a tipping point where it is no longer a robust forest and starts to kind of degrade into a savanna. Those risks are already starting to creep up, even at 1.5C. But scientists say that that's around the stage where we might be able to hold things to a level where most of humanity is still living a fairly comfortable life.
But our homes and our buildings can provide refuge from climate disasters.
We can deal with a lot of the risks by building higher sea walls or stronger bridges or stronger buildings to withstand storms or just investing more in efforts to make cities cooler.
In fact, investing in well-designed, resilient buildings is one of the best ways of adapting to climate change.
How significant is the rise by another half degree from 1.5 degrees to 2 degrees of heating?
The world's top scientists all got together to consider this question in 2018 and released a report. And what they found was that the difference between 1.5 and 2 degrees Celsius means 420 million more people will be frequently exposed to extreme heat. More broadly, the risks of coral reefs all collapsing rises enormously, gets to well over 90% risk of all the world's corals being destroyed. It's a similar story with Arctic sea ice. At 1.5 degrees, it would be ice-free perhaps once every 100 years. But if you get to 2 degrees Celsius, it will be ice-free every 10 years, so 10 times as often.
So what toll will that increased heat have, let's start with, on humans?
Some of the things that you will start to see happening more often is that hot countries will get much hotter. There will be more heat-related deaths in places like India and Pakistan and the Middle East, where they will start to see more days over 50 degrees Celsius. You'll see more flooding and more flood-related deaths in places like Bangladesh, and probably more storm surges in many coastlines around the world. And people will be affected more by things like forest fires, for example. It's sometimes overlooked that this will also have a big psychological impact. Even if people can stay indoors and shelter from the heat, it's going to be quite oppressive sometimes.
On the Greek island of Evia, a dystopian scene. Tourists and residents rescued by boat from the beaches as wildfires rage out of control.
They also estimate, or it's quite difficult to quantify, that it would mean more climate-related water stress, more hunger, more poverty, and a higher risk to food security. And of course, a bigger hit for the economy, especially in the world's poorer countries, because the countries least responsible for causing climate change, mostly in the global south, are the ones that are likely to be worst hit.
And what about the effect on wildlife?
Yeah, this is really tragic. There's been some quite strong data points about the number of species and how they'll be affected. So at 2 degrees Celsius, almost 1 in 5 insect species and 1 in 7 plant species are projected to lose half their habitat. That's double the proportions at half a degree earlier. So in other words, insects, plants, and in fact, vertebrates and most other species except for birds are just going to find that the place where they can exist comfortably shrinks by half.
We're dangerously accelerating toward that 2 degrees. And this is only a global average. Many locations around the planet have seen temperatures soar to much higher levels.
So going by current trends, when are we actually expected to hit 2 degrees?
Well, I mean, hopefully we'll never reach 2 degrees Celsius if the world gets its act together at Glasgow and other climate conferences. But at the moment, we're not doing enough. We are on course for, the United Nations recently said, on course for 2.7 degrees of warming. That's already way, way above where we are now. And that would be by the end of the century.
Over the course of 20 years reporting on this beat, you have reported on the extremes of environmental crises, from the Amazon burning to the melting of the ice caps. What is that like to look up at close?
It's horrifying to watch, really. It's like it's like watching a loved one decline, but that loved one is a loved one that you're part of. It's a privilege to be able to travel to all of these wonderful places that, you know, as a child, I'd only dream about traveling to. But at the same time, it's a big responsibility that you come out of it with something worthwhile. As you said, I've been very fortunate to have traveled to many extreme parts of the world. And really, the fingerprint is everywhere. The fingerprint of climate change is absolutely everywhere.
Well, not to really ramp that, but I mean, if we take a deep breath, on current modelling, the world is predicted to be on course to hit 2.7 degrees, as you said, but 3 degrees is also alarmingly possible. What would that look like?
Well, 3 degrees is very possible still, unfortunately, if there is a breakdown in the climate talks. And at that level, the projected length of droughts goes up to 10 months, which is 8 months more than it would be at 1.5C. So droughts would just be a total fact of life for a huge proportion of the world's population. You'd see the area burned by wildfires more than double what it would be at 1.5C. You know, the Arctic would be ice-free in the summer almost every year, and you'd have much more sea level rise.
If we were on the current trajectory that we're on, and say if COP wasn't a success, what would it look like in the UK?
In the UK, in some ways, we're really lucky because we're not going to get off completely. We will be affected. There will be more floods in the winter. There will be worse heat waves in the summer than we currently have. Start to see maximum temperatures close to 40 degrees. But generally, because we're surrounded by the sea, that tends to moderate temperature fluctuations. So we'd have a harsher climate, but probably not a disastrously harsher climate.
But should people be sort of studying maps of floodplains and start thinking about whether they move or where they live? It's not a small consideration, is it, that your home might be flooded frequently?
I think individuals should consider these things because financial companies are considering these things. Insurance companies are considering these things. Governments are considering these things.
The roof's more or less at sea level behind the shingle that has always held back the ocean. This is Fairbourne.
If the village is abandoned to the sea, then there goes my livelihood.
I mean, people are obviously going to ask questions. Where am I going to live? Who's going to fund it? You know, when is this going to happen?
And if you look at the maps of which areas could be affected by inundation from the sea, there's big stretches of the UK that could go under if we get anywhere near 3C. You know, a lot of Lincolnshire, for example, would disappear.
And even though the UK isn't facing or may not face the worst and most extreme examples of rising temperatures, it still won't be insulated from the global impact, will it?
No, and that's a very important point to make. There's this really dangerous line of thought that, okay, everything's going to get worse. So the best thing we can do is like hunker down, build walls, shut off the rest of the world and look after ourselves. And this is wrong on all sorts of levels. But the most important way in which this is wrong is that it ultimately you might be buying yourself an extra few years, but you're not going to escape. Because if we look, for example, at what happens to other species, we could say, oh, well, you know, never mind, it's just plants or insects. But without those plants and insects, we don't have clean air and we don't have pollination of our crops. So your food supplies might be affected and it's going to be much harder to find a solution. You know, as everybody involved in the climate sphere would say, the longer you wait, the more you pay.
And if we actually get to 4 degrees, God forbid, is that twice as bad as 2 degrees?
It's not quite that simple. Not everything is linear. In other words, you know, the difference between 1 degree and 2 degree is double the temperature as we measure it in Celsius, but it doesn't necessarily mean double the damage for every species or double the damage for every country. It really varies from place to place because we're part of this extraordinarily complex, beautiful, interconnected Earth system where we all depend on each other in ways that we're only beginning to fathom. The most sophisticated computer models in the world right now are all climate models. They try to incorporate more and more of these factors, how clouds affect things, how sea temperatures affect things, how the amount of algae and the size of algae in the oceans absorbs carbon dioxide. It's a wonderful achievement of human science that we are really starting to understand how the world works.
But temperatures in Russia are heating up 2.5 times faster than the rest of the world. And as permafrost thaws, greenhouse gases are released, warming the planet further and melting the permafrost quicker.
The big fear, and at the moment it's an unfounded or at least unproven fear, is that there will be non-linearities That's not easy on the tongue or the ear, that word, non-linearities. But what it basically means is that instead of just rising up smoothly, there will be a jolt where temperatures will suddenly leap way beyond what you would expect, or consequences will leap. There's quite a lot of study of how this might be caused by cascading effects. So the ice sheet might, if when that melts, that can change the movement of the ocean currents, and the movement of the ocean currents can affect certain air movements and temperature rises in certain parts of the world. And all of these different factors can kind of amplify one another. So different tipping points will make other tipping points worse. That's a risk. It's an area where science still has quite a long way to go.
Coming up, what should we expect from COP26 next month in Glasgow? You've told us about some quite scary consequences from significant global warming. Do you think this is inevitable?
I don't think it's inevitable. Definitely not. I've spent a lot of my working days talking to the world's leading experts on climate and on renewable energy business, on biodiversity, on all these different aspects connected to this. And the vast, vast majority of these experts I speak to say it's not too late, but we're getting very close to the point where it will be.
Well, we've heard in this episode from people who are already feeling the impact of climate change in their daily lives now. And are these the kind of stories that world leaders will be hearing in Glasgow? I mean, how important is it that this issue has a human face?
It's absolutely essential that this story has a human face, because one of the big mistakes, I think, that has been made for much of the past 30 years is that these very brilliant scientists we've had who've made very accurate predictions about what will happen to the climate have, for most of this time, assumed that if their science is good and the numbers are strong, then political leaders will do something about it, because that's all you need to do. You just need to appeal to reason. When in fact, what reality has shown us is that human beings are mostly driven by emotion. And if we don't appeal on a human level, on an emotional level, then nothing changes.
What is the most realistic outcome from Glasgow? Can we expect an agreement that keeps temperatures significantly below 2 degrees?
That's the big question that we're all about to find out. I think the best possible scenario would be some kind of Glasgow Pact, where all the countries come together, they all commit to more ambitious action than anything they've committed so far. When you put all of their commitments together, you start to get very close to 2 degrees, or maybe even nudge below 2 degrees. And 1.5 starts to come in sight, thanks to the promises the countries have made. That is reinforced by short-term measures to show it's not just, you know, empty promises, and also a lot more money for poorer nations to adapt. At the other end, the worst possible outcome would be that there is an enormous row and the process loses credibility. People don't trust each other, that they say, oh, well, anyone's just making promises, but nobody's doing anything to achieve them. And then at that point, you start to get more countries kind of heading off in a more nationalist direction. And then temperatures, instead of 1.5 being in sight, temperatures start to spiral away towards 3 or 4 degrees. But the likely outcome is somewhere in between those two things. Some progress over what was agreed at Paris and what has been committed since Paris, and that 1.5 remains achievable, and that this year and this conference pushes the world a little further in that direction. That would be a reasonable outcome. It probably won't be so exciting if it does that. It won't be a hooray, we've solved the problem, but it will be more like a Okay, more work to be done, but we made some solid progress in Glasgow.
John, thank you so much.
You're very welcome.
That was John Watts. My thanks to him and to Jason Glaser, founder of La Isla Network. You can read all of our environment team's reporting at theguardian.com, and do make a point of checking out The Guardian's Climate Crisis Interactive, The Climate Disaster is Here. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Sammy Kent, sound design and original music by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard and Archie Bland. We'll be back tomorrow.
This is The Guardian.